Yes. It's the Midnight Movie Reviews. Colin Suter, Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com join me every week after midnight. We play those themes and we review all the new movies, including all the on-demand films. We'll give you at least a rundown on what you can get in your home on-demand, which is a relatively new way of watching movies before they even come out into the theater. But we've got some major movies coming out. Actually, there's a lot to talk about tonight. So, and I also want to do a quick recap of the Academy Awards, get Colin and Eric's thoughts on how that went. So if you want a movie question, you got a comment, it's 312-981-7200. And we welcome Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello.
And Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
All right, well, let's start out with a quick wrap-up of the Academy Awards. Let's start with you, Eric. How did you think the show went? First of all, like, how do you think Seth MacFarlane did?
Well, I mean, I've been saying for a couple of weeks, and I even said on the show that I thought that he was going to be toned down and softened up a little bit. And I think that's kind of how it went. I think, you know, there have been stories written since the telecast that I think that have been trying to make something more, make his material even edgier than it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was the whole boob song and, you know, what some of those, you know, films he was talking about in the boob song represented.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Jewish stuff. You know, it's like, I think people are trying to make a bigger deal out of it than it actually was. Like, it didn't feel like ooh, look what he went after
right. During
the show. The show itself, I think, was an absolute disaster.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, production-wise, it was just, I mean, I don't get tired of the Oscars. I don't really care when the Oscars go long. I felt they went long.
They did.
This time. It felt slow and sluggish, and it was just full of unnecessary pauses, and it was like 2 hours into the show, they'd only given out like 10 awards.
Yeah.
You know, so I did not have a great time watching.
Colin, what about you?
Yeah, it was pretty bad, and I thought MacFarlane, you know, he served his purpose. That's about the best thing I could say, you know. And I guess it's, you know, he's been drawing a lot of controversy over everything. But for me, the most offensive thing about the show was that, and I didn't know this until after the show was on, that it was produced by the same people who produced Chicago, the movie.
Mm.
And there was so much self-serving, self-congratulatory, you know, moments during the show of that movie getting Best Picture.
Yep.
You know, it was that when I found that out, I was just, it made me sick. Like, that to me was the most offensive part of the show, not anything Seth MacFarlane did.
Yeah. I actually thought Seth MacFarlane did fine. You know, I mean, I laughed at a bunch of his stuff. Some of the things he didn't nail. I agree with you guys about the show being way too long and horribly paced. I was luckily at a very entertaining party, so
that helps.
Yeah, I was with Mike View and some other people, and we were having cocktails, so we were having a good time making fun of it. So it wasn't a miserable experience, but yeah, not one of the best Oscar telecasts. What are the surprises from awards being handed out, Eric? I know that you were not thrilled that Ang Lee won.
No, I wasn't. I mean, there was Christoph Waltz. I don't think it kind of kicked off the show, kind of a surprise, even though
there
were people that said he was in the. I mean, everyone in that category is pretty much in the running.
But that screwed up my Oscar poll. I was out at that point.
there was one other surprise where we kind of went, oh, wow, what was that?
Brave was a ridiculous.
Brave upset us.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that to me, that was the one that surprised me. Actually, I mean, for me, I thought Tarantino winning screenplay, to me, was a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought there was so much controversy over the use of the N-word in that movie that they weren't going to, you know, go with it. But they did, so. Yeah. Show what I know.
I guess I was surprised by Jennifer Lawrence only because I really thought that the buzz was in Emmanuel Rivas' favor at that point. You know what I mean? And I thought they were going to go the old route. I really did.
I thought that was manufactured buzz, though. To me, the Oscars every year, you know, once we sort of get into that groove where we sort of think we know who all the winners are, I think people drum up stories and they try to make a case that someone else is going to win, and then they make a very convincing case, and all of a sudden that becomes buzz. That happens every year, and I think that's what happened with Riva this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say this,
De Niro too, for that matter.
Yeah, I will say this though. I thought Affleck's speech was unbelievable.
That's terrific. Right.
And you know, I like that guy more and more every year.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, he's such a class act. He was so funny. It was such a good, it was a really great speech, and there was no bitterness because he didn't get Best Director or anything
no.
like that. He was talking about how, you know, when he was there for Good Will Hunting, he was just a kid. He didn't know what he was doing. You know what I mean? It was.
And he never thought he'd be back.
Absolutely.
That's the moment that kind of got me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, here he does Good Will Hunting, then, you know, next year he's doing Phantoms, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things. And so, I mean, Argo was in all of our runners-up list.
Yeah, yeah.
So not our top choice. But
no.
I didn't, like, go home going, oh, damn Argo.
No.
I was fine with that.
It's a very entertaining movie, and I thought his speech was one of the best of the night.
Right.
Colin, what did you think of Affleck's speech at the end?
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. I mean, it was very humbling, and, you know, and again, it's like, was he getting a little heat for, you know, saying that his marriage was work? I mean, a lot of people made a big deal out of that, which I thought was kind of ridiculous.
Marriage is work.
It is work.
Let me tell you something. I've been in two of them. It's work.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
I'm like, ooh, what was that about? Ooh, Ben Affleck and Jennifer, what's he saying?
Yeah. She was smiling the whole time anyway.
Right.
So what the hell? You know, I don't.
People are so dumb.
Yeah, they are.
People try to drum up stuff like that. It's so dumb.
It is. All right, you guys, hang on. We're going to take care of the on-demand stuff right after the break here. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. That's the phone number, 312-981-7200. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. Midnight Movie Reviews. Eric and Colin, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right. A little information about some of the on-demand movies. None of us have seen them, but these are the ones that are available. Eric, what do we know about The Brass Teapot?
The Brass Teapot is the one I'm definitely most interested in. It stars Michael Angarano, Juno Temple, and most importantly, Alexis Bledel.
Where has she been?
In The Brass Teapot, apparently.
Yeah, okay.
This is a story of a couple that discovers a brass teapot, and whenever they hurt themselves, the brass teapot fills up with money. How far would you be willing to go?
That's a pretty interesting concept.
Sure.
Wow.
Why not?
All right. And it's always nice to see Alexis Bledel anywhere. Cause, you know,
exactly.
We got to love her.
I'm actually looking forward to taking a look at that one.
Okay, The Brass Teapot. What is Family Weekend?
Family Weekend is a R-rated family comedy. When you hear the description of this, it doesn't sound like an R-rated film, but it's a story of a 16-year-old girl who takes her parents hostage after they miss her big jump roping competition. Stars Kristen Chenoweth and Matthew Modine.
There's another guy. He was
in Dark Knight.
That's right. He was.
That's right.
Terrible in it.
All
right. So I don't know I'm looking at the director of this. His last name is Epps. Is he related?
Is it one of the Epps boys?
I don't know. Doesn't
Great
say.
Great Omar Epps joke on New Girl this week.
Oh yeah. Oh yes, there was, man.
I don't see any relation to an Epps.
Okay.
Here.
All right.
Yeah.
Inescapable. What do we got there?
Inescapable. It stars Alexander Siddig, Marissa Tomei, and Joshua Jackson. And Alexander Siddig plays a guy who has to go back to Damascus when his daughter goes missing.
Yeah.
It's a film that, from what I understand, it kind of starts off like Missing and ends like Taken. But I hear neither in a good way.
Okay. All right.
And yeah,
then the last one that's available newly on demand this week is a movie called War Witch.
Yeah, and that's it was one of the nominees for Best Foreign Film
the
Oscars
mm-hmm.
this year. Mm-hmm. It's a story of a 14-year-old girl who tells a story. She's a pregnant 14-year-old girl in Africa who was abducted by a rebel army, and it's her sort of journey through the army and her training, and then, you know, her sort of try to escape from that life at a very young age.
Hmm.
So I heard very good things about that movie.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Those are your four new on-demand movies that are available this week, The Brass Teapot, Family Weekend, Inescapable, and War Witch. We've got some big movies to talk about here that are in theaters. And first, let's see. Let's talk about, you know, Eric, I haven't seen it, and I don't think Colin has seen it. Colin, did you see The Last Exorcism Part 2?
I did not.
Okay, neither did I. Didn't have time to see it today. So tell me about it, Eric. It looks terrible. Now, the Last Exorcism, the original, I think a pretty solid film until the ending.
I mean, the ending is a little weak. I mean, you know, but a lot of these found footage movies tend to end that way.
Right.
This one was at least a little wacky.
I liked The Last Exorcism. I thought it was an interesting take, and I didn't expect it to be about a con man. You know what I mean? I didn't expect.
It had a lot of it played up a lot of those same Exorcist themes that we've been sort of getting since Emily Rose, I guess.
Yeah.
But it did. I did think it did it in a very unique way, and it was with the found footage, and it was very funny. I enjoy that movie.
Yeah, me too. All right, so tell me about this one.
Yeah, now we have The Last Exorcism Part 2.
Which, by the way, is the dumbest title of all time.
The Never Ending Story Part 2?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's right. So right away, not a very good start.
Yeah.
Okay, this one is not a found footage movie. It's basically kind of takes away the way that Blair Witch 2 did to Blair Witch.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's not found footage, but it stars Ashley Bell, who was the girl who was possessed in the first movie. Mm. And in the beginning of the movie, she is found in someone's kitchen, apparently still possessed, and then she is put in the hospital for a couple months and comes out okay and ends up in, like, an all-girls sort of reformatory house for troubled teens. Tries to pick up the pieces of her life, but Abalam, or whatever the demon's name is from the first movie, is still after her. Maybe trying to possess her, maybe trying to get through her through her dreams, and all this kind of stuff. Not a whole lot of exorcism-type stuff until the very end of the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the movie's only about 85 minutes long. Feels about twice that. It's an extraordinarily dull film. Mm-hmm. Not a lot going on in this film except your usual jump scares. There's not even that many of those. The film itself doesn't have much of a story other than the demons trying to come after her. So there's a lot of scenes of her, you know, imagining stuff and in her dreams and, you know, touching herself while she sleeps and. And it's just, it goes absolutely nowhere and ends on a note that's even dumber than the original. Mm. I was hoping that at least at the very beginning, it was going to, we always, at these found footage movies, we always wonder, well, who actually found the footage
right.
And put this stuff together?
Right.
You know, so like the opening of the movie, actually, you see like, the, you know, that open field where the finale took place and the camera is sitting there. So you're thinking like, oh, someone's going to pick up the camera and we're going to see how this is put together.
Yeah.
Well, no. No one technically ever finds the footage to put it together. But someone does eventually. There's a clip of her on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Possession in a barn.
Okay.
You know, girl possessed in a barn, put on YouTube, and that's it.
Okay.
And that's the entire crux of, you know.
That's the setup.
The setup. So it's a really, really bad movie. It's
like
a complete waste of time. Has none of the flair, has one decent levitation scene,
mm-hmm.
and that's all I can say positive about the movie.
Okay, all right, well, there's a big no for The Last Exorcism Part 2, and we got more movies to talk about. The news is coming up next on WGN. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. And it's the Midnight Movie Reviews. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we welcome Eric and Colin back to the show. Okay. Colin?
Yeah?
Why don't you tell us about 21 and Over?
All right. Well, it's a comedy about three guys in college. One is your, you know, typical loudmouth Vince Vaughn, Jonah Hill type. And then there's the straight-laced, uptight guy. And then there's the other guy, Jeff Chang is his name. And I only know that because they say it about 50 times in this movie in one scene. Anyway, it's Jeff Chang's 21st birthday, and all three of these guys are, you know, on the verge of graduating. So they decide to take one last night out and spend it drinking and celebrating being 21 or over. And, of course, things go wrong. There's an accidental mishap involving a dart going into the cheek of a frat house jock. Jeff Chang gets arrested for public indecency. He just becomes so intoxicated during the movie that he doesn't even know what he's doing, and he ends up being carried around throughout most of the film. There's a sorority made up of Latina women who are after these guys for something lewd and indecent they did in a sorority house. And there's a love interest amidst all of this. You know, your typical generic blonde who keeps running into these guys and, you know, who might have an interest in the uptight, straight-laced guy. And so it's one of these all-nighter comedies. That, you know, it wants to be, you know, super bad, that kind of thing. And the movie also tries to work in serious elements about these guys and their friendship, as well as, you know, their futures and whether or not they're doing the right thing with their lives. And, you know, so this is your typical Judd Apatow movie wannabe. You know, like I said, it wants to be super bad, you know, wants to be raunchy and sweet. And it's from the same writers as The Hangover and Hangover 2. And not the most imagination between these guys. I think John Hughes in the 90s had more imagination than these guys do. You know exactly where all of it is going. Its jokes are made up of gags from other better movies. All the male bonding stuff is really forced and sort of awkwardly inserted into the scene, you know, when it doesn't really call for it. I did laugh a few times, but on the whole, this is really just, you know, a labored attempt at being, like I said, raunchy and sweet. But it's absolutely nothing.
Okay. Eric?
Well, I laughed too, about three or maybe four times, which is about three or four more times than I did during The Hangover. So there's an improvement there. But this movie is pretty awful. It is basically Ferris Bueller's Day Off by the way of Project X. It's just, I mean, the key to, you know, a movie like Superbad is that even, you know, as annoying as you might think Jonah Hill is in the movie, they're still very likable characters. And that's where, you know, this movie completely goes off rails right away. That the main character played by Miles Teller, who is really, really trying to be Vince Vaughn in this thing. It's really quite obvious from the get-go, even though I couldn't stop thinking that the guy looks like Rachel Maddow. So, I mean, the main character is not likable in the least to begin with. You know, I would much rather, you know, hang around with the other guy in the group, the more straight-laced character. Maybe that proves what a square I am. But I thought he was okay in Pitch Perfect last year. So, you know, just having, you know, it's one of those, like, those friendship movies where you don't understand why the two guys are still friends kind of thing, where one guy is clearly, you know, on a path to, you know, try and do something with his life, and the other guy is dropping out of college and just, you know, is drinking in cabs and all this kind of stuff. This movie is slow motion vomit. You know, sorority house pranks and, you know, not even like a good level of like, you know, like gratuitous nudity by way of something like Revenge of the Nerds or anything like that. So, I mean, there's so many ways that this movie fails. And just, I mean, there's no rooting interest in this thing. And when it tries to sort of, you know, these guys, I mean, the track record that these guys have as writers is pretty wretched. I mean, we're not just talking about The Hangover and Hangover Part 2, but also The Change Up and Four Christmases and Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. I mean, these guys are awful, awful writers. And it's like when they try to incorporate this sort of this dark stuff about the Jeff Chang character, you know, it's reminiscent of like the stuff in The Hangover where they're like The Hangover is supposed to have this dark, you know, element to it. And it's like, ooh, look at the, you know, these guys in Vegas and how, you know, screwed up they get. And it just goes off the norm. I mean, it's just not entertaining. It's just not. There are a couple of just weird lines in the movie that made me laugh. But other than that, it's quite awful. It's not Project X awful, but it's down there.
It's terrible. And these guys, you know, you just rattled off that list. And there's not one. Well, I actually, the change-ups had made me laugh, and I don't know why. But the change-up, I laughed a bunch of times during the change-up. I shouldn't have, and I know it's not good, but I did laugh at that. Every other movie that these guys have written is terrible, and this is just yet another one. I mean, this has become these kind of movies have become this like really like subgenre again. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. it's the all-night guys drinking thing. And it's one carbon copy after another. These guys have no originality whatsoever. The characters are incredibly unlike. You mentioned the Miles Teller guy. He's probably one of the most repugnant characters I've seen on the screen in a long time. Just like really unlikable and annoying. And I don't know. I mean, I just this is everything in this movie is so predictable. Every joke you can see a mile away. There's nothing funny about it. The characters are unlikable. This is recycled by this has been recycled by people who have recycled already this crap. And there's nothing, there's just nothing about this movie that's recommendable. It's absolutely terrible. Yeah. 21 and over. And I just really hope that this is a trend that stops really soon.
We exhausted the Harold and Kumar movies, hopefully. So, need something new.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, 21 and over, not good. All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about Phantom?
Okay, well, Phantom is the movie that you've been waiting for all year because it takes place on a submarine.
It's a submarine movie.
It's a submarine movie,
yeah.
And who doesn't like a good submarine movie? Okay, well... This one it's based on a true story. It takes place, I believe, around 1968, when the Russians were on. There was a Russian submarine that sank to the bottom of the sea and was recovered by U.S. forces. And there are many theories of what the true story surrounding this thing was. Well, this movie takes up one of those theories that there was a captain. On the submarine, it was played here by Ed Harris, and there was another group of people on a submarine who were actually KGB agents, led by David Duchovny, and they were basically ordered to possibly basically destroy the United States to test this phantom device on their submarine to make them invisible to radar and all this kind of stuff so they could launch a sneak attack on the U.S. When you watch this movie, it's basically, if you've seen every other submarine movie out there, you can see all the spare parts of those submarines put into this movie. You see, obviously, a little bit of Red October, which, this was probably, Clancy was probably obviously inspired by a story like this. There's actually another story in Red October. There's a little bit of Crimson Tide. There's a little bit of Das Boot. But this film has none of the urgency of any of those movies. It's oddly distracting to have, so some really good actors in this movie, not just, Harris and, Duchovny, sometimes he's good, but Lance Hendrickson and William Fichtner. And these all, we're set on a Russian submarine, and yet none of these guys are even doing Russian accents. So that's weird to begin with. And then the movie, this movie could almost be like a stage play. There's no urgency. With the camera work inside the submarine, it almost just looks like a closed set, and they just kind of stuff the actors into one part of a big metal room. I've seen, better films in the 1950s with better, setting up the surrounding of a submarine film, and this one just doesn't have it, and it's just kind of dull and uninteresting and just kind of, again, putting together the parts of other better submarine films. It's kind of anticlimactic, and it's just not very interesting. You can kind of see how I don't know how this film got a 2,000 screen launch, but the studio didn't really advertise it very well, other than some standees in theaters. But yeah, this, I mean, this is a pretty uninvolving film.
Yeah, it's it's got all the elements that I love about submarine movies.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, but it is, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's every other submarine movie ever made. I agree with you. You know, at least in the Catherine Bigelow movie, they did use Russian accents.
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean?
Right. That's the first thing I thought of.
Yeah.
Like, okay, they might not have been great at Russian accents, but at least there, someone was trying.
Yeah. And this one they don't, and it's really odd. It's an odd choice. I mean, they maybe they could have pulled a Valkyrie and explained it at the, did something at the beginning like they did
right.
in Valkyrie, which I thought worked. That was a concession I thought really actually worked, and I know people complained about it, but I thought it actually worked.
Mm-hmm.
They could have done that here. This is a really sloppy movie, ultimately, and it seemed really like, I don't know what it is, but it just seems like my guess is the shooting schedule for this movie was like 3 weeks. It just,
yeah.
It doesn't it feel really rushed? Like they just,
Yeah, it does. I mean, characters just kind of, they're in and out of the movie, and the whole thing, it never feels like, there's like a progression of something going on. It's just like, okay, it starts off as Red October, and like, oh, here's the Crimson Tide stuff,
right.
And like, oh, okay, now it's going to be the end of Crimson Tide. It's just, and then the ending is, Das Boot, and it's I don't know.
And the cast is loaded with
mm-hmm.
talent, you know what I mean? And it just seems like everybody said, all right, let's make a generic cobbled together submarine movie on a really chintzy set,
yeah.
And shoot it in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like to me. And you're right, man. The fact that this thing got a 2000 screen release, this is a movie that should have gone straight to DVD.
Yeah.
And it feels like that. While watching it, you're like, I should have my fast forward button ready right
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
And that's exactly how it feels. And a lot of really talented people who are wasted. Ed Harris, tries to be intense.
Right.
I love watching Lance Henriksen do anything.
Sure.
Didn't like what happened to him though in the movie.
No.
And so I don't know. It is, oddly enough, this might be the first sort of negative review I've ever given a submarine movie.
Ever?
I don't know.
You don't like Red October.
No, that's not. Right. Yeah, Red October. I'm
yeah.
not crazy.
That's just crazy talk.
Right. But how I have a weakness for the submarine.
Yes,
stuff.
I do.
And I just love it. But this one, very, 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 very disappointed.
That shows you how bad it is, people. Nick DiGiulio did not like the submarine movie.
Yeah, exactly. All right, you guys hang on. We got some other movies to talk about. And everybody hold on. It's Colin, and it's Eric, and it's efilmcritic.com, and it is the Midnight Movie Reviews. Questions, comments, 312-981-7200. Nick DiGiulio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. We've got Drunks in the News coming up, Straight Out of Context, and Nick D's show Spies. And right now we welcome Colin and Eric back to talk movies. Hi, guys.
Hello.
All right. So am I to understand, Eric, that you didn't see Jack the Giant Slayer?
I did not.
Okay.
Colin,
tell us about Jack the Giant Slayer. Just tell us about it.
All right. Well, this is the latest Grimm fairy tale adaptation or modernization or reboot or whatever you want to call it. And it's a variation on Jack and the Beanstalk, of course. Jack is a teenage farmhand played by Nicholas Holt of Warm Bodies, who is tricked into selling his horse for some magic beans given to him by a monk who warns Jack to never get the beans wet. And don't feed them after midnight, and don't... Oh, no, wait, that's not right. Of course, Jack's father is enraged by this whole thing, and that night, Jack is paid a visit by the Princess Isabel, who is in the same predicament as Jack in regards to their relationship with their fathers. Both want to prove to their fathers that they are capable of being responsible. Anyway, she's there in disguise as a commoner because she just wants to get away from that life of royalty for a while. And there's a storm outside, and of course that gets the beans wet. And suddenly a giant beanstalk grows from under the house and reaches way up into the clouds. And Jack and Isabel get separated. She goes up high into the land of the giants, and he falls to the ground and convinces the king to let him tag along with the, I guess they're knights or warriors, to go up to the beanstalk and rescue the princess. So they all make their way up there. And what goes on up there? Well, this land of giants had a war with the regular-sized humans many years or many centuries ago, which Jack knows about thanks to his dad reading him stories when he was a kid. And, well, now that war is about to, you know, rear its ugly head again unless Jack and the warriors that he's with, one of them was played by Ewan McGregor, if they can rescue the princess and chop down the beanstalk before the giants have a chance to get back down to Earth and be nasty. So this is from Bryan Singer, you know, did the first X-Men, two X-Men movies, and Valkyrie, which we just mentioned. He's, you know, one of those mixed bag directors, you know, just some of the stuff I like, some of it I just don't. And this film is, you know, just entertaining enough, I think. You know, it's very passable. I really did like the opening very much. I thought it had a real, like, Brothers Grimm fairy tale, you know, storybook feel to it that I thought was like, oh, this is going to be good. And I thought it elevated it, you know, above the usual retellings that we've seen lately. But it doesn't quite sustain that feeling. It sort of lapses into, you know, conventional action-adventure fare, and it gets a little bogged down in the middle. I think the big battle sequence at the end is a lot of fun and well done and, you know, gives the movie a much, much needed boost of entertainment, especially when I thought the movie was going to end, you know, without that sequence. And, you know, I was very happy to see that it's actually going to happen. And I think the cast is likable enough. And, you know, it's kind of how I describe the movie itself. It's likable enough. I think it's entertaining. It's just not, you know, it's not remarkable, but I, you know, I give it a mild recommendation.
Okay. All right. I'll give you my review after the news. And then we also have to review a film called Stoker, which we will get to. Colin and Eric are with me, and we'll finish up reviewing Jack the Giant Slayer. If you have a comment or a question, it's 312-981-7200. The news is up next right here on WGN. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN. We got a couple more movies we got to review. Live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. We got Drunks in the News coming up, as usual. Straight Out of Context and Snick D Show Spies. But right now we've got to finish our reviews of Jack the Giant Slayer. Eric hasn't seen it, but Colin just gave it an okay review. And so now it's my turn, and we've got one more movie to review after that. Okay, I really like this movie. I thought it was very entertaining. I thought the effects were great. You know, it's not a great movie, but I think it's very entertaining. I thought the action sequences were really nicely done. For me, the strong part of this movie, besides I think really great special effects, and you know, but Bryan Singer can cut together good action. There's no question about it. And there's a lot of it in the movie. But the thing that set this part apart for me was the cast. I mean, I love this cast. I thought the cast was great. I thought everybody was having fun in this movie. And I'm just thrilled that Ewan McGregor is reunited with Spud from Trainspotting in this movie.
It was like,
hey, that's Spud! That's awesome. So, well, anyway, because there's a lot of little details like that. You know, Ian McShane, I will watch that guy do anything.
Sure.
And I thought everybody I think everybody was just having a good time. Ewan McGregor, Stanley Tucci. I mean, please.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so much fun in this movie. I had a really good time, and you know, I thought it was well made, and I liked it. A very entertaining movie. It's not, you know, it's not classic or anything. It's not the Avengers, but it certainly has an interesting take on the fairy tale, and I think, you know, there's a lot of very attractive people in the movie and a really wonderful, eclectic cast that I thought did a really good job and had a lot of fun. And on top of that, some really, I think, fabulous special effects. So I'm recommending it. I thought it was good. So Jack the Giant Slayer. Are you going to get to that one, Eric?
Yeah, eventually. Now that the, especially with the two, you know, recommendations.
Yeah,
I will definitely get to it.
I mean, it's but and again, I was just, you know, I just was so impressed. Again, weird, big budget, over the top special effects, you know, movie, and I walked away liking the cast the best.
Well, done.
So, all right.
I just wish the movie itself sort of maintained the feel that it had in like the first 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think once the Giants come in, it just kind of gets a little too conventional. But you know, it pulls itself. You know, it comes together at the end and sort of, you know, it gets better as it goes along. I just kind of think it gets a little bogged down in the middle.
Okay.
But, yeah.
All right. Cool. All right. Well. All right, Eric. We got one more movie to talk about. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, really quickly, why don't you tell me about the Frankenstein theory? What's that?
Oh, glad to. The Frankenstein theory has kind of snuck into a few theaters around the country. I think it's the only one here is playing at the Streets of Woodfield, if I'm not mistaken. And this is a story of a young man who believes that Mary Shelley's story is not a work of fiction. It is actually a document of true events. And that Frankenstein's monster is still living out there in the Arctic wasteland. So with a documentary film crew, found footage crew in place, they set out to go about this theory of his and see if they cannot find the Frankenstein's monster. Let me just say that I'm glad that I did not go to the theater to pay for this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is one of the rare films where I would have demanded my money back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is, I mean, to go through the trouble, like, okay, you start off with that premise that Frankenstein is, you know, the whole thing is real. Okay, that's okay, go with that. You know, as wacky as it gets, go with that and see where it takes me. And it doesn't even do the found footage stuff well. You know, it's like it's one of those films that can't really decide to commit to the found footage thing. So they have the documentary crew there, and sometimes they switch to the what you know what's going on with the camera, and then sometimes it's a normal movie. You know, so it's one of those types of films.
Mm-hmm.
And to wait basically the entire movie to you know sort of get up there, you know, and to get a guide to you know take them through you know through this area, it doesn't really even I don't even know if the people who made the movie read the book. Or even saw any of the movies, including the Kenneth Branagh version.
Yeah.
Because the entire movie is just basically waiting for the Frankenstein monster to just kind of show up and then just kind of end the movie. That's the entire movie is just waiting for, you know, the sort of the big payoff at the end, which isn't even captured on camera, by the way. The camera is just kind of laid there in a shack, and you hear some grunts, and then someone's dead.
Wow.
End of the movie.
Oh my God! I'm looking at this.
Apparently, this is from the creators of the first Last Exorcism.
Yeah.
You know, not the, I don't think the director. Daniel Spam. Yeah, just for the producers. It might be like the Key Grips who worked on the Last Exorcism.
All right, the Frankenstein theory. Not good.
No.
Okay. All right, Eric. Go ahead and tell us about Stoker.
Okay. Well, Stoker is the first American feature directed by Park Chan-wook, who is most famous for doing his Vengeance trilogy, as it's known, which is Old Boy, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and Lady Vengeance. And this is very much a Hitchcockian-type thriller starring Mia Wasikowska, who plays a girl who on her 18th birthday, she has a very good relationship with her father, played by Dermot Mulroney. But on her 18th birthday, he is involved in a car crash and dies, leaving her mother a widow, played by Nicole Kidman. And during the festivities of mourning and putting his body to rest, a mysterious visitor shows up at their house by the name of Uncle Charlie. And if you're familiar with your Hitchcock, when Uncle Charlie shows up and you're a teenage girl, don't stick around.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, she does stick around. Uncle Charlie is played by Matthew Good. He's very charming, very handsome, walks around, you know, can cook, knows all the right things to say, charms the pants off everyone, including Nicole Kidman's mom. Who's pretty much ready to take with him quicker than Hamlet's mom went with Uncle. And so the girl, you know, sort of begins her own sort of fascination with Uncle Charlie and sort of this sort of burgeoning sexual awakening that she begins to start having. She's a very odd girl at school, very reserved. Dad took her hunting. She knows her way around a gun. And, you know, as the movie develops, Uncle Charlie's true nature obviously begins to reveal itself. And there's sort of this, you know, sort of meeting of the crossroads between where her path of life is headed and where he has come to basically, you know, stick a crossroads in everyone's lives. Hitchcock, obviously, you know, is going to be thrown around a lot. You know, I've said it at least five times already. The movie was written by Wentworth Miller, the actor who was on Prison Break.
Yep.
As far as, you know, actors who write Hitchcock movies are concerned, or faux Hitchcock movies are concerned, I'm going to stick with What Lies Beneath, frankly, as far as sort of stylistic, you know, takes on old Hitchcockian type stories. This movie, to me, is basically one sort of big, beautiful bore to me. I mean, Park Chan-wook obviously knows his way around a camera, knows how to make things very visually interesting. There's a lot of really terrific cinematography throughout this thing. The film just looks just magical, very colorful, very stylized. But it's covering up the fact that there's really not a lot there at the script level. I didn't find this movie suspenseful. I didn't find this movie that's sort of psychologically interesting. Everything, you know, every sort of scene, every sort of discovery goes on a lot longer than it probably should, just, you know, as he's, you know, playing around with, you know, the variations of ways to sort of tell a scene and to edit scenes and stuff. I like the cast. I like Matthew Good. Ultimately, I mean, I was pretty bored throughout this entire thing. And I think the main problem with the film is at the script level. I just don't think there's a whole lot there. And if style is enough, then that's going to be enough to get you through this thing. I require a little bit more. I'd like to have a little bit more substance, maybe a little bit more thrills. So this film is pretty, like I described, is a pretty beautiful bore to me.
Okay. All right, Colin.
Yeah, well, there's not a whole lot I can disagree with on Eric, except that I enjoyed it. you know, if the movie were, if the script were filmed as is, you know, without a director that has some style, I'm sure I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much. But I found myself sucked into this movie's, you know, weird little world and all its sensibilities. And, you know, I dug it. You know, it's one of those movies like Blue Velvet, where it takes place in, it could take place in present day, but yet the movie feels like it was made in the 60s, and you're not quite sure where and when this movie really exists. And I love that the camera is always alive in this movie, and you know, I think the performances are pretty terrific across the board. But you know, again, this is a case of style over substance. But for me, the style is so worth watching, and so far this year, you know, we haven't seen much in the way of movies with, you know, that have real personalities to them. And they've all, you know, most of the movies we've seen this year have been pretty plain, you know, pretty banal. So it's refreshing to me to see a movie that is, you know, finally, you know, really alive. And, you know, not just that, but like I said, I also enjoyed the performances quite a bit. I thought the actors, you know, lifted the script up as best they could. And so on the whole, I was entertained by this movie.
I'm with you, Colin. I really liked it. I thought it was great. I'm a huge fan of this guy's work, though. I just think he's an extraordinarily talented director, and I love everything that he's done, including this. It's not the most complicated thing in the world, but it really got under my skin. I was really sort of, I thought it was a very, you know, a very provocative film, and there were certain sequences in the movie and certain things that happened that really sort of got under my skin and kind of freaked me out a little bit. I think all the performances are absolutely stellar in this. I think as you mentioned, Colin, this guy visually, there's not many directors who have made movies in the past like year or so that were able to like really, you know, really do such a beautiful job telling the story visually and stylistically. And I just think he's a great filmmaker, and I really enjoyed this movie. And I was a little nervous because, you know, a lot of the directors who come over to America to start making American movies, they seem to, you know, sometimes not have as strong a showing as they do in their native country. But I think this is, yeah. I think this is pretty strong. I think it's consistent with his other stuff, not as violent as his other stuff. I mean, he's known for some pretty incredible violence in his other movies.
There's some pretty disturbing, violent moments in this movie.
Yeah, there are.
A couple, you know, by American standards, I guess.
Yeah.
You can say it that way.
Yeah, but I was this movie got under my skin, and I liked it, and I think it's a beautifully directed film, and it's beautiful to look at, and I was very entertained by it. I thought it was really great. Not for everybody, though.
No.
Not for everybody.
I think most people will lose patience with this movie pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I think.
Might be the case. I'm not sure. I found it very provocative and interesting, and I really dug it big time. So.
Yeah. And it's only playing at the Landmark Century on Diversey.
Right.
That's what the theater's playing at.
Yeah. Is it going to open wide?
I would expect it might open wider. I mean, it's Fox Searchlight. They do like to do that. But
yeah.
It probably all depends on how well it does. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, it's there you go. So there's some stuff out there that we disagree on this week. All right. That happens.
Well, sure.
Yeah. All right.
I will say this. It's the best movie I saw this week. Stoker. I didn't like it, but it's certainly the best one.
Yeah. All right. Well, it was no Frankenstein Theory.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
Oh, boy.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, what do we got next week?
What we got? We got Oz the Great and Powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And we got Dead Man Down. Next week,
yeah,
with your boy Colin Farrell.
That's right, yeah.
And what we got? We got Emperor with Tommy Lee Jones and Matthew Fox,
and he plays MacArthur in it, if I remember.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Tommy Lee Jones plays MacArthur in Emperor. I'm confused by Dead Man Down. I'm looking forward to it because you know,
yeah,
it's from the director of the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original,
right.
And, you know, I love me some Colin Farrell. And it's like, it's produced by the WWE.
Yeah.
I'm like, where the hell?
Really?
Where did that come from? And then.
I don't know.
Wade Barrett is in it.
Who's that?
He's a wrestler.
Okay.
So I don't know what.
Is that his wrestling name, Wade Barrett?
Yeah, Wade Barrett is his name. He's a British
terrible
guy.
Wrestling name.
And he's in it. And they keep. There's a storyline on wrestling now where. Why am I blanking on the Irish guys? Sheamus is coming out, and he's making fun of Wade Barrett's acting and showing clips from the movie where Wade Barrett doesn't really say anything. Every scene he's in, he's just kind of standing there, kind of out of focus, standing behind Colin Farrell.
Okay.
And so they've made it a storyline where they're making fun of how bad he is in the movie. So I'm like, what the hell is this? It just seems very strange to me.
There's also a documentary opening next week called "Don't Stop Believin', Every Man's Journey,"
mm-hmm.
which apparently is about the guy that took over for Steve Perry in Journey.
Oh, you're kidding!
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. All right. Well, there
so
you
that's
go.
That's opening.
All right, we got some big ones next week. I guess the biggest one next week, obviously, is Oz.
I will actually be in South by Southwest on Friday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I don't know if I'll be able to join you for a full show, but I will be able to call in with a special report on a little movie I'm seeing that night called it's called Evil Dead.
Yeah, all right.
Dude. Yeah.
All right.
I will be able to call in and let you know how that one is.
Yeah, I can't. I don't know if I've been this excited for a movie in a long time. I mean, my God, is this thing going to be insane? All right, cool. So you're going to see it South by Southwest. It opens here in April, correct?
April 5th.
April 5th.
Yeah, premiering Friday night at South by Southwest.
All right,
and
cool.
I'll wait.
Cool. All right, well, you give us a report, and we'll get a full report from South by Southwest, too, maybe on the Saturday night?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
I think so.
All right, Eric, Colin, thank you, guys.
Okay.
All right, have a good one. There you go. There's Eric and Colin, and they always review the movies with us on WGN. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number on WGN. We're going to be coming up on our regular features.